This episode of the Security Ledger podcast is sponsored by Aporeto. Aporeto is the leader in identity-powered security for cloud applications, containers, and microservices, enabling distributed zero-trust security for apps, networks, and users. The Aporeto platform protects cloud applications and networks from attack and prevents lateral movement by authenticating, authorizing, and encrypting all communications with a cryptographically signed identity assigned to every workload. A uniform distributed security policy is enforced per workload, independent of network or infrastructure configuration, enabling automated security orchestration across hybrid and multi-cloud environments. For more information, check them out at aporeto.com. This is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, the Editor-in-Chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 146.
You know, the reason organizations move to the cloud is because of DevOps, is because of faster software turns, is because of more agility and having a more flexible infrastructure. Security technology, however, it's stuck in the past.
DevOps methodologies are transforming the way organizations create and consume software. In our second segment, we speak with Amir Sharif of the firm Aporeto, a leader in identity-powered security for cloud applications, containers, and microservices. But first, there's ample evidence that nations like Russia, China, and Iran are interested in inserting themselves into elections in the West, including in the United States. Whether or not they will succeed depends in part on the cybersecurity of political parties in the U.S. and Europe. That's why a new study from the firm's Security Scorecard is reason for concern. The survey of more than 20 political parties in the EU and four major political parties in the United States found indicators of poor security hygiene in almost every political party. Those range from expired website certificates to insecure web applications and even evidence of malware and botnet infestations on IT infrastructure operated by the parties. Still, the news wasn't all bad. To get a better sense of what the political parties are getting right and wrong, we invited two of the study's authors in to speak with us. Jason Casey is the CTO, and Paul Gagliardi is the Director of Threat Intelligence at the firm Security Scorecard. In this conversation, Paul, Jason, and I talk about their survey of political party cybersecurity hygiene and how weak cyber hygiene can contribute to disinformation campaigns designed to undermine public faith in the election system.
This is Jason Casey, and I'm the Chief Technology Officer at Security Scorecard.
This is Paul Gagliardi. I'm the Director of Threat Intelligence at Security Scorecard.
So this is Jason speaking. So Security Scorecard operates a global intelligence collection and analysis platform. We focus on monitoring the cyber hygiene and kind of behavioral dynamics of entities. An entity could be a corporation, it could be a nonprofit, it could be a political party. So for the political report, what we did is we built a couple of portfolios tracking just four political parties in the US and 20 some odd political parties throughout mostly Western Europe. So the way our platform works is we collect all sorts of data about basically devices that are connected to the internet. These could be devices that are physical things. It could be devices that are virtual things, as well as digital artifacts. The number of signals is actually quite high, but we can really kind of bucket those signals into one of three bins, if you will. So one bin is information about the hygiene of assets controlled by an entity. For instance, is a web server serving an expired certificate? The next category is really behavioral. It's less about looking at the assets under control of an organization and more about trying to analyze or understand how is an organization managing those assets. So given that we see how the systems change and we have a basic set of rules, is it possible to infer the organization's behavior, process, and quality of their process that's driving that change? And then, of course, the third category is what we call a security incident. So an incident isn't necessarily a breach. It's not necessarily a severe event, but it's definitely something that is suspicious that generally doesn't operate in an environment without some sort of malevolent behavior or adversary involvement. And a simple example would be malware beaconing out of an organization or an organization exhibiting the scanning behavior of a botnet infection. So we take all of these signals in across these three bins, and we do a lot of kind of statistical analysis and data science to understand of these behaviors, which of them more correlate strongly to bad outcomes versus good outcomes. And ultimately, that process produces our scores, the A, B, C, D, or F. So in the portfolios for the political parties, what we did is we looked at the party's performance over the course of 90 days in Q1 of this year, and we specifically zeroed in on anything that was driving low scores across some of those parties. Specifically to the Republican and the Democratic parties, we also looked at their overall performance over the preceding, I want to say it was about 30 months or so. And so the methodology was to kind of use our base platform, much like our customers would, to understand where should our security team actually spend time in terms of adding context and building a narrative or a story around what may or may not be happening inside of an organization.
What is interesting to me is, you know, typically, obviously, you guys are working with enterprise, large enterprise, you know, public and private organizations. Political parties are generally much more amorphous. So one question I had is, how do you figure out, first of all, what constitutes the party, and then from there go on to actually identify, because you're working kind of externally, their IT infrastructure?
So the question that you're asking is the basic question that we call attribution. So this is a different style of attribution than you may be familiar with. We're not necessarily trying to attribute the actor behind an adversarial campaign. We're actually trying to attribute the assets under control of a particular entity or organization. And so it turns out there's no straight answer. There's no singular response to answer that question. It's actually kind of a field of techniques that we bring together in something called compositing signals. I'll give you a for instance. So one particular party may have a couple of properties that they like to use from a domain name perspective. Those domain names are generally controlled by a governing entity. Those domain names will typically serve some sort of assets over something that can be viewed through HTTP or HTTPS. If it's on HTTPS or if it's a secure site, there will be a certificate involved. That certificate will basically sign, again, against that name or property. So in everything that I just described, there's a lot of kind of telltale signs and hints that any assets that are serving these names and resources are likely under the control of a particular entity. And it turns out after multiple passes across several sources, you can kind of build this signal up to where it eventually crosses a threshold.
So let's say in the case of the US parties, you know, there's a wide range of national and state level entities, you know, congressional campaign committees, senatorial campaign committees, the main party organization, the state level party organizations. Were those all kind of part of the mix for you guys, or was it more looking just at the national structure?
We mostly focused on the national parties in this particular study. We are planning a more campaign-based study over the next quarter or so. But for this particular analysis, we mostly focused on the national party.
Let's get to the results. And again, you're looking both in the US and in the EU, so across the EU nations. And at a high level, reading your report, there were a lot of findings. In other words, parties, especially seemingly in the EU, were challenged on matters of information security. And talk maybe a little bit about what you guys found at a high level.
So the high level takeaway was the at the national level, the Republican and the Democratic Party actually exhibited fairly good hygiene and behavior. The unifying factor that drove most of the findings in Europe and then some of the small parties in the US seemed to be more about organizational size. And this kind of starts to tease out a question of, is a certain level of donations and sizes necessary to run an effective security program? Now, while we don't necessarily answer that question, it certainly seems to be a recurrent theme.
My team, which is composed of penetration testers and security researchers, we sort of took the findings from our platform and dove in as if we had received that scorecard and really tried to find some specific findings and textualize what we're seeing here. Our high level was that the RNC and DNC were pretty well buttoned up. We did find some instances where there were some security instances that we don't think are best practice, but they weren't completely egregious. The real egregious findings occurred in our smaller U.S. political parties and then abroad pretty consistently. And we, you know, we've outlined those in the report, and I'd be happy to dive into any of the details of the specific findings.
I guess when we're talking about the outward-facing infrastructure of these parties, what types of assets and infrastructure are we talking about here?
Anything that serves a certificate is basically something that can be discovered. So not just web application servers, but APIs, API instances, things like VPNs, VPN concentrators.
Remote logins for email usage, we found a lot of. I think it gives a good perspective. It's as if we were pretending to be the attacker without a specific set of IPs or machines to attack. We just try to determine what it means to be a part of an asset of an RNC or DNC, just as I think a real world attacker would. I sometimes find like a penetration test that I'm sure these organizations are utilizing are sometimes focused specifically on certain assets defined by the IT team. Sometimes it helps to
think like an attacker.
Yeah, exactly.
So just to put a little spectrum on there, it's not unheard of to basically find services and equipment across the spectrum, whether it's things like RDP services to Mongo administrative consoles to exposed SCADA controls. In the past, we found all of those, not necessarily in this particular report, but there's a lot viewable from the outside. And from an adversarial perspective, the first step that you would do in any sort of concerted campaign is basically to generate a target list. And this is kind of exactly what we do from an outside-in perspective. There's a lot of information that's both observable actively against that public-facing infrastructure. There's also information that leaks out of the inside of an organization that can sometimes speak to the intent of an organization, as well as the responsiveness of an organization. And we try and build a composite picture that really is kind of multifaceted, that takes all of these signals into account, and then use that to kind of understand, at least at a starting point, how is this organization performing? What are their likely weak spots? And if you are going to conduct a further in-depth analysis or from an adversarial perspective, build a campaign or a plan, you would then build from that report.
So running down a list of problems that you found, and again, this is both U.S. and European Union parties, a wide range. You talk about a U.S. party you studied that had personal information exposed that might be used in phishing or targeted attacks, all the way to, I don't know if it was an EU party or the EU itself, kind of an active malware infestation on some part of its network that was, I guess, beaconing out. So a wide range here and expired certificates and so on. What was the most serious or concerning discovery you had? And what was, I guess, the most common type of flaw you guys found?
I think the most serious one we found was the smaller US party that we found seemingly an old web application that allowed a user to query via first or last name, and out would pop a list of birth date, current address, PII related to that. It seemed like it was set up for some event, I'm imagining. It was called voter validation form. So we immediately disclosed that. You know, the sensitivity of that PII is very important. Also, I don't think everyone wants to be their political affiliations to be made public. So we immediately disclosed that.
And was that one of the major two parties?
No, we're not naming the party, but it was not one of the major two.
So, I mean, looking across your various ratings for, you know, and you rate these parties in these countries by, you know, overall cybersecurity hygiene and then on some specific measurements like application security and patching and so on. At the high level, just scanning it, you know, United States kind of seems like we're in the middle of the pack, sort of 50th percentile across the board. But, you know, sacre bleu, France is at the bottom of the list on a number of these measures. France, in fact, seems to be a laggard. On the information security front, at least. So talk about that.
I'll preface it a little bit, and then Paul can kind of get into some of the details. But the one thing to just caveat is our analysis is not complete with respect to all of the active political parties in Europe. With that said, when we're talking about the U.S., our report does cover probably, you could say, 90 to 95% of the active parties, at least at the national level. So of the parties that we looked at, France certainly scored at the bottom of the pack. And then Paul had some specific observations.
Yeah, coming into this report and working in DOD and intelligence community, we always regarded France as having rather sophisticated you know, federal offensive and defensive techniques and infrastructure. So I thought that would actually relay to the defense of the political parties. But, you know, as we observed in 2016, having strong national intelligence or defense-related cybersecurity capabilities does not necessarily relate to...
Doesn't translate all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You sort of meant the mental assumption that, you know, some of these people will rotate out and work for some of these parties or something, and the skill transfer will happen. But as it turns out, maybe that does happen, but somehow it doesn't translate into better hygiene. The nation of Sweden generally was at the top of the list. Could you just, in a minute or two, talk about what the folks in Sweden are doing so well?
Honestly, with Sweden, Sweden had such a small infrastructure that it was easier for them to score well by just managing that small infrastructure well. Mm.
So true in so many other areas as well.
Yeah, there's something here in terms of the law of large numbers, right? Like, people forever on tiny islands because you don't have a statistical sampling.
Right. I've written about this before, and I think others have noted it. You know, political parties and political campaigns are notoriously difficult to secure because it's a very cyclical environment in which there are periods of really intense activity around elections that are very compressed. And so people are spinning up, you know, new websites and sending data here and there to try and kind of get over the hump. And then everything kind of goes quiet, and there are long kind of fallow periods in which, as you guys have already noted, sometimes those assets that you create and stand up just kind of get ignored and forgotten about, but they're still out there. I mean, is that something that you observed in your analysis, that sometimes these vulnerable assets and infrastructure were kind of mothballed, or, you know, something that had come about in the context of an election and then just sort of been forgotten about?
So it certainly seems that some of the assets that we discovered were honest forgotten assets, if you will. One corollary I would like to draw, though, is that exists in the corporate world just as well. Like, a common thing that we actually come across in the corporate world is companies with actual deep budgets or deep pockets, big budgets, and sophisticated security teams having stranded assets, assets that they forget about, that they decommission improperly, that still actually has keying material on them, but no longer is under active management, as well as a phenomenon of kind of ad hoc IT happening kind of across the board. The other behavior that happens a lot in a certain subset of businesses that resembles parties is when you look at kind of mergers and acquisition activities, and when you look at kind of high intensity SWAT teams, if you will, doing very quick development or very quick turnaround activities, they exhibit much of the same behavior. And so just kind of as a basis for how we had to build our platform out, we had to build it to kind of track that level of dynamicism. So I wouldn't necessarily say that it presents a problem in terms of discovery and tracking, but as with most things, humans have a hard time manually managing and tracking things when those things number in the thousands and move quickly. And I think generally what we find when we look at organizations, whether political or not, is a mechanized and procedural mechanism for discovery, monitoring, and continuous tracking isn't necessarily always in place.
Presidential election coming up in the United States in 2020, EU elections, really we're on the eve of those in the European Union. Is there a dotted line connection between the vulnerability of some of these parties and I guess their data and some of the stories we read about, you know, manipulation and information operations targeting, you know, attempting to sway or influence voters and elections?
Absolutely. The heart of a disinformation campaign is information, right? And typically that information can be made up, that information can be stolen. When a political organization doesn't run a good defense and opens itself up to information exfil, it's basically providing ammunition to any sort of adversary, whether they're a nation state political action group that is not necessarily playing above board, or even some sort of organized criminal element. I think the dotted line that you can draw is, and several other people have already kind of written about this, the amount of disinformation campaigns that are playing out right now in terms of the far right in Europe are actually quite high. Whether we're talking about the latest events in Austria, whether we're talking about what's going on in France under the movement with Le Pen, I believe similar things are happening in Hungary and Poland. The disinformation campaigns are actually fairly active. In terms of the political entities, if the political entities aren't running button-up shops, they're basically just exposing themselves and providing more food for the fodder. And I think that's generally true in kind of any Western democracy. So if you want voters to engage, the voters have to have trust in the system. It's difficult for them to maintain trust in the system if the trust is continuously being eroded effectively through these disinformation campaigns. So it's not a one-stop dotted line, but it is a dotted line through a couple stops.
If you were to speak to these parties, both in the U.S. and in the EU, what would be your, you know, here are things that you're doing well, and here are areas where you really need to make improvements?
Tactically, we could make some specific recommendations, but honestly, I think the from a policy side, there's a couple of things that might be barriers, certainly are in the U.S. and possibly overseas. But number one is good security shouldn't only be the forefront of the main political parties, right? And so then the obvious question becomes, well, what's getting in front of good security or strong security from smaller parties or new campaigns? In the U.S., there's a little bit of a sticky situation where when companies donate time and money to a political campaign, they basically end up making political contributions. I don't think you want that to be the cost to a security company trying to help a nation that it operates from a political perspective. I don't know if that's necessarily the same over in Europe, but a key theme that we have noticed is the smaller organizations just are not as effective. But we do think that this is a world where the smaller organizations need an effective defense. And if so, if they're not effective, there's a reasonable question of can they be effective without help in some form or fashion.
As we head into 2020 here in the United States in the presidential election, I mean, we heard so much about hacking in the context of the 2016 presidential election. It was certainly a big fear, although I'm not sure we saw any major incidents around the midterms. But how should voters and the public be feeling going into 2020?
I think we still have a lot of issues that we need to clean up, both tactically and strategically, right? Like a proper cybersecurity defense is necessary at the national level as well as at the campaign level. Now, we don't have details to talk about on the campaign side just yet, because that's kind of one of the next works that we're going to jump into. But clearly, this is not a solved problem. Clearly, third parties with adversarial intentions are already engaging today, both in Western Europe and in the United States, from a disinformation perspective. Without appropriate kind of tools and processes and people in place, that's going to continue to be a major participant in our elections process, which is clearly kind of not in our interest.
Have you reached out to any of the parties that you surveyed and shared with them your results?
We have. If we find something that we know they need to address and we need to address quickly, we run that through a disclosure process. And so we've done that with all of the parties. In terms of sharing the reports with the parties, that's not something we've actually done. We'd be happy to, but those aren't the connections that we have.
And Paul, for these parties, what would be, from your standpoint, what would be the best way to get their arms around, you know, what their risk posture is, you know, starting from ground zero, starting from today?
Yeah, I think just taking that global internet perspective and not necessarily focusing in on just your core infrastructure. It's being concerned about all the domains that you may have purchased and just parked that might be ripe for social engineering, where you didn't properly manage the DNS or SPF records. I think that's my biggest takeaway, is that it seems like we found some shadow infrastructure that was forgotten. We also see that in Fortune 500s as well, but you know, in penetration tests and in standing up of your defense systems, just to make sure you have full coverage of the public facing infrastructure, not just what you define as your perimeter.
Okay. So if we were to decide the 2020 presidential election today, not based on votes, but based on who had the better cybersecurity hygiene, who would win?
Honestly, that's a tough call. Like most of the journalists we're talking to really kind of want us to call that out strongly. The Republicans and the Democrats are both running a pretty good game. The one thing I'll give you, how about this? The Republicans have definitely made it harder to discover their full footprint than the Democrats.
Uh-huh.
With that, said, they're both running fairly decent hygiene across the assets that are discoverable.
Thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Awesome. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Jason Casey is the CTO, and Paul Gagliardi is the Director of Threat Intelligence at the firm Security Scorecard. They were here talking to us about Security Scorecard's new survey of party cybersecurity in the U.S. and Europe. Up next, change is afoot in the enterprise. The embrace of DevOps methodologies is fast replacing monolithic software stacks with more nimble distributed architectures. At the same time, organizations are swapping out physical data centers and moving workloads to both public and private clouds. But all that change brings with it cyber risk, and security technologies, unfortunately, are generally stuck in the past, designed to monitor more static environments of on-premises physical IT assets. In our second segment, we're joined by Amir Sharif. He's the co-founder and vice president of business development at the firm Aporeto, which provides identity-based access control for users and applications in hybrid on-premises and cloud environments. In this conversation, Amir and I talk about how DevOps and cloud are transforming enterprise computing and also enterprise risk and security.
My name is Amir Sharif. I'm the co-founder of Aporeto.
Amir Sharif, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast. It's great to have you.
Paul, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Amir, maybe to start off, a good thing to do would be to tell the listeners about Aporeto, what your technology is, and what business problem you solve.
Aporeto provides identity-based access control for segmenting workloads and access to infrastructure across hybrid clouds, as well as traditional clouds that are on-prem and public clouds. So think of us as a way of measuring both user and workload identity in order to meter access to resources. And metering access would be for both end users when they're interacting with applications through APIs, or for applications themselves if they're interacting with themselves through the network in some way.
So, Amir, tell me about the Aporeto team. Who do you have on board there with you?
So, we are three co-founders, but we are lucky enough to have a wonderful set of developers. These are world-class people, and I can make that claim because I'm old enough to have worked both at Sun Microsystems and VMware, where it was a collection of really high-end, high-class individuals. When I look at our core developer team, they are of the same class and really lucky to have them. Beyond that, the broader team that gets the product to the market, all dedicated, all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed. Everybody has the professionalism that they need, yet they have the flexibility and the curiosity that you would expect to have in a child. So the playfulness of a child, but the maturity of an adult in order to bring out a fascinating new and creative product out to the market in a way that's absorbable by the customers quite easily.
There's just so much movement to, first of all, to cloud and really to containers as a way to deploy applications. Talk a little bit about some of the security or implementation challenges that companies encounter on this journey as they're adopting, developing, rolling out into production these cloud-based containerized applications. I guess that's the why Aporeto question, if you will. What are some of the challenges that present themselves to organizations that are on this journey?
Of course. Broadly, there are two secular trends that are happening to data centers and the software that's running on them. The first one is the migration away from software monoliths to more distributed architectures. So whether we had before as one big monolith that got broken to a traditional three-tier application may now be a collection of, let's say, 16 different services that interact with each other. And the reason that shift has been made is so that individual software components can be updated more rapidly and the feature velocity by businesses, feature output velocity by businesses is higher.
This is DevOps, I guess, broadly speaking.
Broadly speaking, that's DevOps, exactly. So that's trend number one. The second secular trend is the migration towards public cloud. So, whereas before all my assets were inside my data center with a well-defined perimeter, now much of my infrastructure is moving to one or more public clouds, and I have to manage a hybrid infrastructure. So what has happened is that the well-defined application now is disaggregated and components of it are coming up and down very rapidly. And more importantly is that part of my infrastructure doesn't belong to me anymore. And as such, I've lost visibility. So I have both a scale challenge that's presented by the application architectural change and a control challenge that's presented by my migration to the cloud. And this is happening as we're going from a servers-based architecture towards a serverless environment, with VMs and containers being stopping points along the way. And each inflection point, we're seeing a bigger scale problem and a bigger control problem. And this is why Aporeto is around.
Identity ends up being a kind of a huge issue or feature around these deployments. And that's one of the things that Aporeto kind of helps organizations manage. When we're talking about identity, we're not just talking about user identity, we're talking about application and process identity. Talk about just the role of, I guess, identity management in, you know, securing these cloud and hybrid cloud applications.
So traditionally, we've had a poor way of assigning identity. So we've used location or IP addresses as a proxy for identity. So let's say that, you know, I live in 123 Elm Street, and my dog lives there too. And if you come to that particular address and you assume that anything there is me, you might get me or you might get my dog. That's a problem with using IP addresses as a poor man's proxy for identity. And if you look at human interactions, we have a pretty rich sense of what identity is. You know, for example, with my friend, I know his name, first name, last name. I know his parents' name. I know his tone of voice, his gait, his clothing style. I just have a ton of information that about my friend that makes it hard for somebody else to come and pretend and masquerade as my friend. And our goal and what we have achieved with Aporeto is to give applications the same robust and attribute-rich sense of identity. So what Aporeto does is automatically generate rich identity for applications while giving the database, or rather the system administrators or security administrators, a way of easily creating policy to manage their distributed infrastructure and the distributed applications using identity attributes in a way that's quite flexible and powerful.
You know, generally, I know Aporeto has a broad customer base, but generally, you know, what types of industries or companies do you see out front on both investing in cloud and also leveraging the services of a company like Aporeto for security?
Our customers are generally larger customers, and they've been around long enough to have a hybrid environment. So addressing security both on-prem and off-prem in a centralized way is important for them, as well as having a unified approach to, let's say, having legacy servers, VMs, operational containers, as well as some serverless workloads. The market segment that is most attracted to Aporeto is the one that has either a regulatory or a reputational risk of losing data. So either there's a government mandate that you will not lose data, or if there's no government mandate, there is a serious enough risk, a reputational risk that comes with a breach that you take security quite seriously. Now, I wish that more companies would take security seriously because it's a matter of privacy. It's a matter of individual freedom and also a matter of protecting business jewels. But it's the companies that tend to be regulated who take security more seriously than others. And then beyond that, there's companies that know that they would have a reputational risk if there were a breach.
I know you guys were at the Google Next user event that was earlier this year. I'd be interested in your take on kind of what came out of that show, especially on the security front, what the state of play is amongst these huge cloud infrastructure providers in terms of working with startups like yours and also evolving their own platforms.
So the main announcement that came out of the Google Next conference was announcement for Andros, which is a way of having both a public cloud, in this case it's GCP, at the disposal of the company, but also having a portion of that public cloud on premises. So think of it as kind of a extra net of GCP that lives on premise. And that way you can have your cake and eat it too, meaning that if you need to expand your services on premise, but have it easily connect with the cloud, Andros will take care of that for you. VMware has done the same announcement with AWS, with Outpost. Azure has had the service as well. And what we're seeing and what we saw at the Google Next conference is the culmination of all the major cloud providers providing a method for both on-prem and off-prem services in a way that's natural to enterprises and in a way that's easy for them. So everybody's trying to create these extra enclaves, let's call them, these outbound or non-attached enclaves of their infrastructure on-premises to make it easier for the customer in the hope of expanding their businesses and expanding their underlying cloud ecosystem.
If you don't mind me asking, what's driving that on the customer side? Obviously, they're doing that in response to needs that they're hearing from their customers. What are those needs?
As much as I hate to say it, it's inertia. It's the way that we've always done things. If you create a system and a set of processes that assume an on-prem deployment and you're starting to adopt cloud, not every part of your infrastructure is going to be easily migratable to a public cloud. As a business, you want the best of clouds in a way that respects your existing procedures and methods of doing things. So that's why it behooves the cloud service providers to create these extra enclaves and locate them on the customer side. So the customer mimics having an on-prem installation while having the benefits of a public cloud managed by somebody else.
Now, I know Aporeto is kind of agnostic as to the cloud provider. You do a lot of work with Amazon Web Services. I mean, are there for customers, for listeners out there who are contemplating or working in a company that's looking to, move some application or applications or workloads to the cloud, are there meaningful differences between the major providers, the four or five major cloud infrastructure providers out there?
There are some meaningful differences. For instance, the maturity of a Kubernetes stack is better on some cloud providers over others, while other cloud providers have a richer portfolio of services and may emphasize databases above other services. So there is differentiation. But when it comes to core services, which is compute or networking, and that's a staple. Everybody has that. But you do see, specifically for AWS, an extra push on database and database management. So, they have the Baskin-Robbins flavors of databases for you, and that makes it easier for the enterprise to come in and pick the database technology that's appropriate for them. Google is well known for its machine learning capabilities and big data management. So TensorFlow is kind of their core capabilities. And Azure is very friendly to Windows workloads, and that's currently about 50% of enterprise workloads. So they all have their own respective strengths while having excellent base minimum fundamental services.
Among those is security, of course, but I think one of the dangers is that organizations might sort of engage in magical thinking that by going to an Amazon or a Google cloud that, their security problems are solved, that they are now leveraging the security of Amazon or Google when, of course, they're not. They're still responsible for their own securing their own application. What are some of the security pitfalls or mistakes that you see organizations making as they maybe move into production on one of these platforms?
Right. So there is what I call an impedance mismatch between an agile infrastructure and generally available security technology. And of course, Aporeto excluded from that party. What I mean is that the reason organizations move to the cloud is because of DevOps, is because of faster software turns, is because of more agility and having a more flexible infrastructure. That comes with the ability of re-architecting your solutions and taking advantage of new exciting technologies that are container-based or serverless-based, and you can orchestrate things much better and much higher scale. And if you build them correctly, ultimately your infrastructure will be much more efficient. It will be more cost-effective. Security technology, however, it's stuck in the past. It's stuck in a world that assumes a low rate of change on the network topology, so it's IP-based. Think about firewalls, east-west firewalls. You know, they maintain tables of who can talk with whom. And that's with the general assumption of the location information doesn't change frequently. But the whole purpose of cloud is for you to have a fungible environment and to use services and bring them up, bring them down, and location shouldn't matter. One of the critical mistakes that companies make is using existing legacy technologies in order to apply to a cloud-native environment. And what you ultimately want is security that's built for a cloud-native environment that is backward compatible with your existing infrastructure. And that's what we have built at Aporeto.
You know, as you just said yourself, we are at this kind of interesting inflection point where there is this emerging new normal of organizations, enterprises, let's say, moving workloads to the cloud. At the same time, they have substantial investments in hardware, software, services on premises in data centers that they need to continue to maintain. As we know, it's very difficult to just get rid of things, get rid of technology once you've invested in it. How do you see them negotiating that? And how does Aporeto kind of navigate that as well? Where do you guys fit in?
If you are in a static environment, meaning that your business has grown and it's no longer growing, or your IT practices are fixed and you're fine with that, there really is no need to change any practice that you have. And as it would be true for any startup, it's really hard to break into that kind of static environment. What we have, luckily, I mean, what we're living through in 2019 is sort of a rebirth of renaissance, but in this case, it's for IT technology. It's not about art. It's renaissance of, you know, the creativity that's focused on creating new IT technologies. And that provides a lot of opportunity for startups like Aporeto to insert themselves into the process. And that insertion comes in with a new project. I have And my projects could be something like, I'm now re-architecting an existing application, or building a brand new application. But as you pointed out, in an enterprise, there are a lot of existing assets. And even if you build a brand new application, you still have to connect it back to existing services that you have, most notably existing data sources, in order for that new application to give you the most value. So the way we preserve that capability for companies is we attach to the new workload, we secure it with identity, we allow it to have a security posture that's completely independent of the infrastructure, and we give the companies to have a zero trust capability that this application will only respond to services that it knows based on authentication authorization. And as we backhaul to existing infrastructure, we can provide basically backward compatible methods, like having access control lists that plug into your existing infrastructure. Or in many cases, we also create automatic identity for an existing workload, whether they're OS processes, VMs, traditional servers. It doesn't matter to us what the form factor of the application is. It's all about identity. And we create that identity for the existing infrastructure, and we bridge the two worlds, the cloud native world and the legacy world, in a unified way where identity determines who can talk with whom, while the operator has centralized visibility and centralized control for policy, regardless of where the application components are running.
And in the brave new world where we do all this and we get it all right, how does security look? Are organizations, enterprises more resilient to cyber attack and application-based attacks and compromises?
That's certainly the goal, but you want to have the right hygiene. I mean, if you don't want to get sick, you have to wash your hands. You have to do the right things. The same goes true for security. And you want to make it easy for, you know, metaphorically, for companies to wash their hands so they don't get sick. So that's why we have created the method to automatically generate identity and automatically generate policy so humans don't have to do a whole lot of work. What you don't want to have is a lot of infrastructure complexity. To do the metaphor, right? Imagine if in order for you to clean your hands instead of washing it once, you had to wash it 7 or 14 times. And at some point you say, okay, that's enough. I'm going to put up with the risk of getting sick. The same is true for enterprises. Getting sick is getting penetrated by a hacker, basically. or a data loss, and it's a business risk. So by making it easy for companies to generate identity and to generate policy and simplify their infrastructure where they don't have to have as many east-west firewalls, they don't have to have as much CapEx expenses in these middleware boxes that are built on old technology, we make it easy for people to wash their hands to stay secure.
We're coming up on the end of Q2. What is on Aporeto's roadmap for 2019 and beyond? This is a really, as we've said, fast-moving, fast-evolving space. What are you guys at work on?
We are lucky to have wonderful customers who have given us the opportunity in deploying in massive server farms. So between two different customers, two specific customers, we are deployed on 500,000 servers, and that's a dream come true for Aporeto. Our goal is to maintain the capability of operating our security solutions at any scale, not just for the ultra large scale like these companies, but also honoring our smaller customers who are on 100 servers or so. So continue providing an excellent, stable platform, whether the scale is 100 servers or 1,000,000 servers, and being able to give the customers the ability to come out of outages quite quickly. So let's say that your entire data center goes out. With Aporeto, the security should come up as soon as the servers are booted. So these are the things that we're working on a much more scalable and responsive and reliable system.
Amir Sharif of Aporeto, thanks so much for joining us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Amir Sharif is the co-founder and the vice president of business development at the firm Aporeto. You've been listening to the Security Ledger podcast. This episode of the podcast was sponsored by Aporeto. Aporeto is the leader in identity-powered security for cloud applications, containers, and microservices, enabling distributed zero-trust security for apps, networks, and users. The Aporeto platform protects cloud applications and networks from attack and prevents lateral movement by authenticating, authorizing, and encrypting all communications with a cryptographically signed identity assigned to every workload. A uniform distributed security policy is enforced per workload, independent of network or infrastructure configuration, enabling automated security orchestration across hybrid and multi-cloud environments. For more information, check them out at aporeto.com.